Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Congressman Jim Clyburn of South Carolina played a major role in the story of this 2020 presidential campaign when his late endorsement of Joe Biden in the South Carolina primary led to a landslide victory that revived the Biden campaign and launched the former vice president to the nomination. But in South Carolina, Clyburn has long been a legend for his 60 years as a civil rights activist and political leader. And he's a force on Capitol Hill as the longtime Democratic whip, the number three leader in the House. I sat down with him this week to talk about the election, the tragic events in Kenosha, and his own extraordinary life. Here's that conversation. Congressman Jim Clyburn, it's good to see you again.
Thank you.
The legend has only grown since...
Get out of here.
Since the 2008-9-10 period when we were working together. I want to talk to you about your amazing journey. But before we do, I want to ask you about the convention last night and the general state of our campaign right now, the politics right now. Did you watch the convention?
Yes. I watched, I don't think I watched the first two speakers, but from then on, I watched it very closely and was just amazed. I don't know why I would have expected something different, but I thought that what we saw last night was just more of division, more of wedge issues, more of just a throwback to what I thought we had gotten beyond. I think I took the president at his word when he said that there would be uplifting, and I...
You didn't feel uplifted?
Not at all. I don't see how anybody could have.
Well, you know, you are one of the best politicians that I've run across. So you're a student of this. Obviously, he was talking to his base and was feeding his base the red meat that motivates his base. Some of that has to do with race, obviously. But he did feature a couple of your fellow South Carolinians last night. Governor Haley and Senator Scott. And they were there, I assume, in part to provide a sense of diversity and to give him some cover on that issue. What was your reaction to their remarks? Because Scott went after Joe Biden pretty hard on issues of race.
Yes, he did. I was a little bit taken aback. You know, I was not surprised that he would be pro-Trump. I was a little bit surprised that he was so anti-Biden. The fact of the matter is, when you look at the voting patterns here in South Carolina, the February 29th primary, everybody expected Joe to do well among African-American voters, not quite as well as he did. I don't think anybody expected that. And everybody who looked back missed something. And that is, and it was around Charleston, where you saw white voters, independent voters, voting in the Democratic primary that had not voted in the Democratic primary in a long time. Those numbers were very surprising to me. And so I was a little bit taken aback when Tim went after Joe as much as he did. I've been saying a lot of people shocked when I called Joe Biden an adopted son of South Carolina. Joe Biden has spent more time in South Carolina than any other place outside of Delaware. And so I'm not surprised that he did so well. I was a little bit surprised that he had a 29% win.
Well, I was going to get to this later, but I should ask you, I mean, this, a lot of that expanded margin is attributable to you, is it not? I mean, your endorsement turned out to mean a great deal to the vice president then.
Well, that's what the surveys indicated after the vote. I think the...
must have been gratifying.
It is. But, you know, I was following my heart. My late wife was just such a big fan of Joe and Jill. And before she passed away, we had talked about it a whole lot. And then the Friday before the South Carolina debate, an elderly lady sitting on the front pew of a church that I went to for a funeral service of my longtime accountant. And she called me over to her. And she said to me, she says, I need to know who you are voting for in this primary. And if you don't want anybody to hear you, just lean down and whisper in my ear. And I did. But when I did that, the look, she snapped her head back, and I saw this look in her eyes, her facial expression. And she said to me, I needed to hear that. And this community needs to hear from you. And that's what made me move as emotionally as I did with my endorsement. When she said that she needed to hear it and the community needed to hear from me. And I talked to a few people before I left Columbia that evening, and sure enough, they were waiting to hear something from me. And so I did what I did, the way I did it, because I think the South Carolinians in the Democratic primary was waiting on somebody to validate Joe Biden. They wanted to vote for him, but they did not want to vote for him if he did not have validation. So I may take credit for it, but I'm not deserving of it. It's the people of South Carolina.
No, I think you deserve some of it for sure. So last night, when Scott's critique was of, you know, by some of the familiar ones we've heard of Biden, you know, the crime bill and other aspects of his very long record. But the larger critique was that Democrats had failed African Americans, and that, you know, Democrats essentially had taken African Americans for granted. How did that sit with you, and what's your response? Because the fact of the matter is that these injustices that still exist today have existed for a very long time. And there is an impatience, particularly among younger African-American voters. What's your message to them?
Well, my message is very clear. I think that we ought to be instructed by history. I think that when you really deal with things just on an emotional level, you have to take into account as to what contributes to your emotions. The fact of the matter is, in 1992, when I was running for Congress, I received my worst treatment at a gathering, town hall meeting, in Atlantic Beach, South Carolina, a black town with a black mayor. And I came out against mandatory minimum sentences. Was not created in the 1994 crime bill. They were, I think, a 1986 crime bill. And I came out against that. And I almost got run out of the place. I mean, these people
were so incensed over the drug activity in their communities, they didn't want to hear that from me. And so that's why you saw a lot of the Congressional Black Caucus members voting for that 94 crime bill, because of their experiences back with their constituents. And so what people miss is that so much that was in that crime bill, violence against women, the assault weapons ban, community policing, these things were very popular with us, and they went away when Newt Gingrich came along. And so there was some very positive, at the drug courts, that went away. And so nobody talks about what really contributed to mass incarceration. It was those safeguards that were in the legislation when Newt Gingrich took over in November of 94, and all those things went away. And so I don't back away from the fact that I voted for that crime bill. Bernie Sanders voted for that crime bill. Quite a few other Congressional Black Caucus members voted for it. And so Tim Scott is a bit off base with that. But it's working for a lot of people, and it's working for within the Democratic primary. It was working as well. So I don't blame him for using it. I will say this, though. If you say that Democrats take blacks for granted, I will take you back to 1964, 1965, the Great Society programs that the Republicans keep saying failed. Well, they did not fail. The 1965, look at what Lyndon Johnson signed. The legislation he signed into law back in 1965. You can start with amending the Social Security Act for Medicare and Medicaid. You can look at, everybody goes back to the 65 Voting Rights Act, but I look at the Higher Education Act. I looked at Elementary Secondary Education Act. There's just a plethora of things that came into being. That was a Democrat, a Southern Democrat. Lyndon Johnson was from Texas, and he gave us the Great Society programs that are still with us today. Head Start is still there. And though the Voting Rights Act has been gutted by justices that are of Trump's liking, how can you say that Democrats take blacks for granted? People just ignore 1965, but you can't ignore it. And that went right now through 1968 with the Fair Housing Law, that Trump is now trying to turn the clock back on the Fair Housing Law that came to us in 1968, before Richard Nixon was elected.
So do you think that it gives Trump cover with, if not minority voters, but white voters who are troubled by his appeals to on race? Does it give him cover that Scott spoke, that Haley spoke, that Herschel Walker offered his testimonial that Trump is not a racist? Does that move the ball for Trump?
I think words are great. But deeds are greater. And I think it's Trump's deeds and those of us who are going to be sharing with the voting public going forward, his own words. I plan to use these words as we go forward in this campaign. So, no, I don't think he got cover at all. I hope my Democratic colleagues will take stock of that. And it's not just last night. You know, I'm having some hard time. I have three daughters. And when I look at a president looking in the camera and referring to an African-American woman who actually was on his staff at one time and referring to as a dog, I can't get over that. And I don't understand how any black person can get over that. You know, I can't understand how anybody in the faith community can tolerate. I could see somebody repenting. But when you do things and you don't repent, and you say that you've never felt the need to ask forgiveness, and you tell me that you are a fundamentalist Christian, and here's a guy who's never felt the need. We all have sinned and fallen short. And we ask for forgiveness. But here's a guy who says, I've never felt the need to be forgiven for anything. So we aren't going to let people miss that going into this election. You don't know which side of the Bible is up. That's a problem.
One other theme that ran through, and you sort of hinted at the suburban couple from St. Louis that brandished their guns when marchers went by, and they had a very tough message, very racial message. But I want to ask you about what's going on right now in the context of this, because what's going on in Wisconsin, for example, in Kenosha, where there was this awful shooting on the weekend of a young black man, and there were peaceful protests, but at night there was looting, there was arson, there was rioting, and it seems to, you know, plays right into Trump's message and the message of the convention, which is Democrats, you know, coddle rioters and looters, and you know things are out of control, and this is going to wash up right on your door. And he's the thin blue line, as it were, between you know that and these suburban communities and so on. It's not very subtle, Congressman, but does it worry you? I know you were very quick to jump on the defund police movement.
Yes, I was. Yeah, it worries me a whole lot. The last conversation I had with John Lewis before he left Washington to go home for what we knew was going to be his eventuality, we talked about this. We talked about Black Lives Matter movement, and we were so pleased with the fact that it had broken through. And last survey I saw said that, 60% of the American, 70%, over 70% of American people support the Black Lives Matter movement. And John and I felt that they had broken through in such a way that beyond what we ever did back in the 1960s. And we were both fearful of that phrase, defund the police, and what it could do to Black Lives Matter. And we equated it to burn, baby, burn back in the 1960s. So I fear for that. Now, watching that young man take 7 shots to the back, not from down the street, right as his car door, within 12 inches, this guy's just pumping bullets in his body. You know, that's beyond the pale. And so, you know, though you don't want to see that, that was a tough thing to see. In fact, I said to someone earlier today that to me was even worse than the knee to the neck. This was just, I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So, but I don't know that we should respond. I've said that violence is their game. And I learned playing sports that if the opponent ever gets you to playing his or her game, they're going to win. And so violence is their game, and we ought not play their game. Because if we play their game, they will win. If we want to win, let's play our game. The game that we know how to play, and the game we know can be successful. Don't fall in the trap of playing their game, irrespective of what may have precipitated it. Let's just don't play their game.
You know, you've spent a lifetime, like with as participant in a bird's eye view of politics in a state where race has always been front and center. Do you see the power in what they were doing yesterday by invoking this image of anarchy on the streets and so on?
Yes, I do. And that's what makes me fearful. I've been watching Jamie Harrison's race here in South Carolina.
Against Lindsey Graham, yeah.
Yes. Nobody expected Jamie Harrison to break through the way he has broken through, simply because he has been having a common sense discussion with South Carolinians. And he has defined himself in a way that nobody thought he could. People have decided that Jamie Harrison is the kind of person that would represent me well in Washington, and they are not afraid of the fact that his complexion may not be as vanilla as theirs. And so I know what they were trying to do last night. And I would hope that observers of this will understand what they're trying to do and not play into it. Because quite frankly, I think that South Carolina, which was the first to succeed, could very well be the launching pad of what will be a real New South. Now, I've been around long enough to know that Ralph McGill, the old Atlanta Constitution, talked about a New South decades ago, and John West, who was my mentor.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about him.
He had the New South. But this is really a genuine New South development.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. And I just want to ask you briefly about your folks, who both had such admirable stories. Your dad lost his parents when he was 3 and had a kind of rough road up. And there was a story about him that you tell that in certain ways lays bare the brutality of racism. And that is that he attended the 7th grade 3 times. Right. Not because he wasn't able or skilled or skillful enough to move on, but explain why he had to be in the 7th grade 3 times.
My dad grew up in Kershaw County, South Carolina, and at the time he was growing up, they did not provide education for blacks beyond the 7th grade. Whites went on through the 11th grade, at that time public schools. Went to the 11th grade. And so my dad repeated the 7th grade 3 times. And then finally the teachers told him he just could not, they were not going to let him back in, and he was too far advanced to the other students, and they would not let him come back to school. He then went and got a job in a bakery shop, and he learned how to bake, but he also kept studying. And he finally studied enough, he thought, and took a college entrance exam and passed it and was admitted to Morris College in Sumter. He and my mother moved to Sumter for that express purpose because both of them wanted to go to college. And so my dad went first, but after the 3rd year, he was called into the president's office and was told that they didn't have a record of his high school graduation and was not going to be allowed to go into the 12th grade, to the 4th year, his senior year, until he got, his diploma. Well, he didn't have a diploma, so he never went back. And so he was denied a college education for that purpose. Yeah. The college finally, I told that story at a speech one day, and the president of the college was there, and he thought I was making that up. He came to me afterwards, he says, in fact, if I had known the president of the college was sitting behind me, I don't think I would have told the story. But I didn't know he was back there. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, I've never heard this before. He said, is that true? And I told him, yes, my dad told me that. I said, he wouldn't have told me. And he didn't tell me until about 4 or 5 months before he passed away, before I knew the story. And
yeah,
somebody else, one of his classmates, kind of cued me in. And
yeah.
I went and asked him.
Was he embarrassed? Or why didn't he share that story with you before?
Well, the night that I went to ask him, a minister who was in a class with him told me that story. And I called my dad that night. And I was way down in Low Country of South Carolina. And I drove straight back to Sumter, where he was living. I knew he was dying with prostate cancer. And I went to his house. It was after midnight. And I told him what I had heard. And with tears in his eyes, he told me that he had never told us that story because he didn't want any of us to ever think that there was any value in dropping out of school. And he thought that might have an impact. So that's why he never told me. My dad died about 3 months after he told me the story.
Your mom was quite a force as well. She was a kind of an entrepreneur and an activist, active in the NAACP, and you were as well. You were like at 12 years old. You were president of the youth NAACP. This was right that was pre Brown versus Board of Education.
Absolutely. Yeah, This was I was elected president of my youth council of the NAACP a little over a year before Brown v. Board of Education. It was before my 13th birthday. And my mother was a big fundraiser for the NAACP. She was a beautician, but she's beautician extraordinaire. At one point, she had 16 operators in 2 beauty shops that she owned. My mom was just that kind of person. In fact, when I wrote my memoirs, most people, to them, the best chapter in the book was a chapter about my mother. She took me to the courtroom. An old court case came up of Shep Nash, a lawyer over in Sumter, where we grew up, sued the NAACP. And that's when the Southern states set about to try to break the back of the NAACP. And in that lawsuit, a young lawyer, Matthew Perry, came to Sumter to defend the NAACP. And he was something else. My mom's closed the beauty shop and took me down to the courtroom. She said, I want you to see what you can be when you grow up. Matthew Perry just illuminated that courtroom. He lost the case, but he won the hearts and minds of the people of Sumter, South Carolina. And when I got to Congress, my first bill.
I know the story, yeah.
You know the story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell the story, yeah.
Well, the story was I just wanted to do something to honor Matthew Perry.
Who was not just a great, he became a judge, right, as well. He was a
federal judge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
when he became a federal judge, I decided that I wanted to name a courthouse for Matthew Perry. Columbia had been designated as the site of a federal courthouse. There's going to be a third federal courthouse in Columbia. Got that courthouse named for Matthew Perry.
But it wasn't, there was a little complication, right?
It
was right next to the Strom Thurmond courthouse and Senator Thurmond, who was around then, thought the annex should be named for him as well.
Yeah. You know, Thurman started making speeches right after that courthouse was designated, and he would always refer to that proposed courthouse as the Strom Thurmond Annex, because the federal building adjacent to the site is the Strom Thurmond building. And so Strom, when I put the bill up, Strom opposed it. Of course, I got it passed the House, but he was going to keep it from passing the Senate. And I did some research and found out that the federal building with his name on it was never named by the Congress. It was done by executive fiat. The administrator of the Jones Services Administration named it that. And so I put the word out, sent him word by a former congressman that if he did not remove his objection to my legislation, that I was going to put up a bill in the House to name, to take his name off the federal building. And of course, I knew he wouldn't pass the Senate, but it would pass the House back then.
Yeah.
I think it would pass the House today too. He removed his objection. And so the Matthew J. Perry United States Courthouse stands here in Columbia.
Did you guys have a conversation about it?
No, I did not have a conversation with Strom about it. Sent him word.
Through an intermediary, yeah.
Yeah.
He must have respected the power play, huh?
Oh, yeah. No, we talked about it afterwards.
Oh,
yeah,
I see.
We talked about it afterwards. Yeah. Strom and I got to be pretty good friends. I was very good friends with his sister, Gertrude. He had a sister that I worked together with his sister in the Employment Security Commission. And he always talked about how much his sister loved me. And that was the base of our relationship. So I got along well with Strom.
One of the things that came up during the campaign was Biden was attacked because he spoke at Strom Thurmond's funeral. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that. Because, you know, the thing was, how could you speak at a... By the way, I appreciate the fact that instead of being named after a segregationist governor, that courthouse was named after a crusading African-American attorney and judge. But what was your reaction when Biden came under attack for that? Thurmond asked him to speak at his funeral.
Yes, he did. And of course, Biden had this relationship with Strom, much like the relationship I had with him. And I think that it's very unfair for people to expect you not to maintain civility in a legislative body. Because Democrats are in the majority in the House, but we are not in the majority in the Senate. And if you're going to get legislation passed, it's got to pass the House and the Senate. And so just this morning, I spent time on with Congressman Johnson from Louisiana, very conservative. We're working on broadband stuff together. I think it's good for people to be able to disagree, as I disagree with my current governor, but I work with him in order to get legislation done for South Carolina. I work with Tim Scott. I'm working with him now on justice and policing. We don't agree politically, but I work with him. And I think that's a good thing to do. And I don't think you ought to hold it against a person like Joe Biden for working with people. They're sitting there with votes in their hands. And sometimes they're sitting there in the majority. And if you can't create a climate within which to work with them, you aren't worth being in a legislative body, because legislative bodies are all about gathering people of various backgrounds and experiences and trying to find common ground. And Joe Biden has always been able to find common ground to such an extent. Somebody like Joe, like Strom Thurmond, asked him to speak at his funeral. And he was requested Fritz Hollins. He spoke at Fritz Hollins' funeral, and I joined him in that. And I don't think, and I had people to criticize me for eulogizing Fritz Hollins. But, you know, my eulogy about Fritz Hollins was very clear. I came from the poem, "Thank God a Man Can Change." His family appreciated the way we dealt with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody knew Fritz Hollins' history since 1947. He ran as a segregationist and he served as a segregationist, but thank God a man can change. Yeah. He changed.
You went on to South Carolina State in Orangeburg. You mentioned John Lewis earlier. Your relationship went back to then because you were also a civil rights activist. You were trying to desegregate the lunch counters in Orangeburg. You were arrested at the time, and you were one of the early organizers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which along with John Lewis. Tell me, first of all, about that period of time and your experience in trying to desegregate these lunch counters, and then tell me about how you came to know Lewis.
Well, John Lewis and I first met in October 1960. We were both 20-year-old college students. He was in school down in Nashville at I think it was the American Bible College. I've got the name of it before you went to Fisk. He was down there, and I was at South Carolina State. And we all met in, I think it was April of 1960, up at Shaw University, up in Raleigh, North Carolina. And of course, all of the activities that started out on February 1, 1960, up at North Carolina A&T, and started spreading throughout the South. The city ends was something that just caught on. And so we decided that things shouldn't be willy-nilly. We ought to organize this stuff. So we met in Atlanta at Morehouse College in October 1960 to formally organize the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And that's when I met John Lewis. And that's also the weekend that I met Martin Luther King Jr. And we set up with Martin Luther King Jr. that night for what was supposed to be an hour meeting starting around 10 o'clock. I came out of that meeting almost 4 o'clock the next morning, and it was a Saul to Paul experience for me. Now, I tell everybody, John Lewis was different from all of us. We accepted nonviolence as a tactic. John internalized nonviolence. It became a way of life for him. And when John Lewis was ousted as chairman of SNCC, which is the nickname we had, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, he became the director. Not immediately. Now, he went up to New York for a year with the Field Foundation, but he came back to Atlanta and took over the Voter Education Project that was sponsored by the Southern Regional Council. I was down in Charleston at the time, and I became chair of the Charleston Voter Education Project. So John and Lewis and I have worked together registering blacks to vote all over the South. I concentrated mostly in South Carolina. He was the regional director. And then, of course, after a stint on city council, he ran for Congress, lost the first time, and he ran again in 1986 and got elected. And of course, I joined him in Congress in 1992. And we kept that friendship throughout all those years. And both of us, for whatever reason, married librarians. His wife was a professional librarian, and so was mine. And they became fast friends. And so John and I enjoyed that relationship right up to his death.
That must have been terribly difficult to say goodbye.
It was. It was. In fact, I couldn't sleep that night, and I got up early the next morning and did something I've not been able to do since. I got my device and put it, stacked it on some books, and I went out in my backyard, and I did, I figured out how to work that device, and I did my farewell to John, and I have not been able to do it since, but he... It kind of went viral.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned your wife Emily. You met during those sit-ins.
Met in jail. Yeah, Emily and I met in jail. I was had been incarcerated around 10:30 that morning, and around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, she came to the jail along with other students who had not been arrested that day, because we filled up all the jails. They could not. Oh, they run out of jails. They put us in cow pens. Over 300 students were arrested that day, but there's about 5,000 students marching. And they all went back to the camps, and some of them came back to the jail to bring us food. And she came toward me with a hamburger in her hands. I reached for her. She pulled it back, broke the hamburger in half. Gave me half of it. She ate the other half, and I was so grateful that I married her 18 months later.
You is sharing hamburgers for the next 60 some odd years, huh?
Yes, 58 of which we were married. We stayed married over 58 years and had a 60-year relationship. In fact, we met March 15th, and the following October 15th is when I met John Lewis. So those 60 years with John, I also shared with Emily.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You spent a lot of the 60s in various community-based roles, Big Brother programs, developing youth programs, working for the South Carolina Farm Workers Commission. But you mentioned John C. West, and you ran for the legislature and lost. I should point that out. I can't skim by the bad stuff in the narrative here.
Sure.
How did that sit with you? You ended up losing three times in running for public office before you went to Congress. How did you process those losses? Did you just see them as a step in the road, or was there a time when you said, well, maybe this isn't for me?
Well, no, I never felt that this was not for me. I always felt that politics was my calling. And right out of the sit-ins, I started working, as I said, with the Voter Education Project. Then in 1969, I ran a campaign for the first African-American to get elected to Charleston City Council since Union Divide. And when I was selected to run that campaign, I went to sit down with St. Julian one day because I really didn't know him and I wanted to get to know him because I'm going to manage this campaign. And when I started asking questions about him, he finally asked questions about me. And when I did, he says, well, where are you from? And I told him, and he asked me about my wife, and I told him, he says, wait a minute. He says, are you married to P.J. England's daughter? I said, yeah. He said, man, that's my cousin. So that just struck up a great relationship. And so I got really deeply involved in South Carolina, it's this time Charleston politics. And so I ran for the state legislature a year later, won the Democratic primary, but I had run as an insurgent. And therefore, I did not have the support of the powers that be. And so because I didn't, though I won the primary, they did not come on board to support me in the general. And therefore, I lost the general after having been declared the winner around 10 o'clock in the evening. I was told the next morning that rather than being a 500 vote winner, somebody had forgotten to carry a one, and I was a 500 vote loser.
Well, at least you got a good night's sleep.
Yeah, not really. A reporter came to my house at 3:30 in the morning.
Oh, is that right? That's how you got the news.
Yeah.
So you went from there. You went to work for John C. West. He had been the lieutenant governor. He became the governor. You were the first black aide to a South Carolina governor since Reconstruction. And tell me about that. Tell me about him.
Well, John West was an interesting guy who a lot of people didn't know it. John West was a member of the NAACP. He joined the NAACP in Clarendon County, where Brown v. Board of Education started at Briggs v. Yeager. He was a member of the Manning branch of the NAACP. But when I lost that race, and a reporter asked me what happened, and the rumor was floating around town as to what happened to those votes, I said I didn't get enough votes. And the reporter pressed me, but I would never change that line. It looks like I didn't get enough votes. So that became the headline in the newspapers that Thursday morning. John West was coming through Charleston on his way out to Kiowa, which was a hunting preserve at the time, for a little R&R, and he saw the headline, and he called me. And he told me, we will not leave our wounded on the battlefield. And he invited me to his staff, and I've never looked back since.
He was, as you say, kind of one of the faces of the New South. He was, relatively progressive on race issues. You created a human relation. He created a state human relations commission, and you were chosen as the commissioner. And you spent 18 years there.
Well, I was on the staff for 3 years before that. Mm-hmm. I was on his personal staff. And then my first job on the staff was to help form that commission. Because another thing happened in 1969, we had the hospital strike.
What about, I thought you were going to say the Orangeburg Massacre.
No, the Orangeburg Massacre took place some years before.
Mm-hmm.
But the hospital strike was in 1969. The Orangeburg Massacre, I think, was 68.
Yes, right.
Right. But that hospital strike led to some real, even martial law was declared in Charleston. For 100 days, that strike lasted. So John West got elected in 1970. We had the Orangeburg Massacre in the background, the hospital strike. Then in 1970 is when South Carolina was ordered to integrate its schools. The schools still were not integrated after 1954. 16 years, the schools were not integrated. And then we were told that either integrate in September or lose federal funds. That led to a big riot at a school in Lamar, South Carolina, where buses were overturned. And this was in September of 1970. And so you got 68, 69, 70, serious racial issues. John West running for governor against a guy named Abbott Watson, the Republican from Lexington County. Everybody thought Abbott Watson was going to win. But John West eked out an 18,000 vote victory statewide and became governor. And in his inaugural address, he pledged a colorblind administration and set out to keep that pledge. And that's what led to me being on his staff. And then later on, I became the commissioner of the Human Affairs Commission. A lot of people think I was the first commissioner there. I was the second. I was the first member of his staff. But we hired somebody else to run the commission. And then when that person left, the commission asked me to come take it over because the legislature was trying to get rid of it. And they thought that I had enough of a relationship with the legislature that I could save the agency. They didn't want the first agency run by a black person to be eliminated. And that's back to what you were talking about earlier about Joe Biden. These are very conservative people who were trying to get rid of the agency with a black person running it. And so my job was to try to save that agency. And it meant I had to go to legislators that I didn't agree with on much. Some of them I didn't agree with on anything. We saved the agency.
And you said, like I said, you spent 18 years at the agency. And I'm wondering what that experience was like in a state that has such a hard history on race relations. You probably went to work every day past the Confederate flag. You maybe drove past Confederate monuments. The Confederacy was celebrated. I mean, it was obviously South Carolina sort of the was core to all that history.
Sure.
How did you deal with all of that? And how did you deal with the pace of change, which obviously wasn't nearly and still isn't nearly fast enough?
Look, John Lewis took a lot of licks to the head of many people back in the 60s, were spat on. When I was marching, sitting in down in Orangeburg, I've seen eggs smashed in people's hair, I've seen people spat upon. I've seen water hoses turned on people. And of course, South Carolina is a little bit different from Mississippi and Alabama. You never saw cattle prods used in South Carolina. You never saw snarling dogs in South Carolina. South Carolinians were a little bit different, but just as steadfast in their beliefs in the Confederacy. So when I sat in the governor's office, the Confederate flag was flying on top of the state house. And so when I went to the Human Affairs Commission, there was a state senator who still lives. He's a neighbor of mine. Kay Patterson took to the floor of the House one day before he went to the Senate and spoke out against the Confederate flag flying on top of the state house. And all hell broke loose. His life was threatened. In fact, a guy got arrested and spent time for threatening. I came to his defense, but I did it differently. I went and did some extensive research, which I usually do with stuff like this. And I discovered something like I did on the Strom Thurmond's building. I discovered that that flag on top of the state house was not the Confederate flag. It was a battle flag. It's the Tennessee flag. Bedford Forrest popularized that flag. That flag became popular because of Going with the Wind, the movie. But the Confederate flag, the stars and bars, is the flag of a circle of stars with three bars. And so I wrote an editorial, an op-ed piece that was published in the Charleston Post and Courier, and I called it Romancing That Flag. And I gave the history of the flag on top of the state house and said, that's not the Confederate flag. It never was a Confederate flag. Always was rejected by the Confederacy. A lot of people didn't like that. And I ended up my last 5 years in state government. I had a full-time law enforcement agency with me whenever I traveled. In fact, there was a period of time when law enforcement people would stay in my house with my wife and children when I was not at home because of the threats I got because of that flag. But it revealed something that a lot of people did not appreciate until they took it off the state house. When they decided to take the flag off the state house and put it on the state grounds, they put a different flag on the state grounds. It wasn't the flag that was on top of the state house. Even the one they put on the grounds was not the right flag. That was the flag of Northern Virginia.
That's funny. Finally, in 92, as you mentioned, you went to Congress. You've obviously risen steadily through the ranks there. You're the third ranking Democrat in the House. I want to ask you a couple of questions about this. One is, what are the things? I had Speaker Pelosi here a week ago, but you know, you mentioned voting rights earlier. You renamed the Voting Rights Act that the House passed, the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act. Do you anticipate that will be law, presuming yes. Biden and the Senate win? And what other sort of signature bills that you think are important to you will that have been bottled up will be law if Biden is elected and a Democratic Senate is elected?
I think the number one thing ought to be the Voting Rights Act. And I really think that even though I'm very pleased with what we've done with the Voting Rights Restoration Act that we have now called the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act, I really think we ought to take a hard look at the things in that act that we could do in order to ensure that we have voting made easier, not to leave things up to the states, as we've done. If you remember, when we lowered the voting age to 18, states did not necessarily agree with that. So we said, okay, but in federal elections, you will be able to vote when you turn 18. Now, states didn't want to set up a two-tier system, and so then they decided to lower it at the state levels. But there are a lot of things we can do for federal laws that may be left up to state for state laws to do. So I want us to take a hard look at that bill and make sure, especially if Biden is elected and we get a Senate, a Democratic Senate, then we are going to take a real strong look at the Voting Rights Act to make sure that the things we are now experiencing are done. Then I want us to take a hard look at targeting resources. We like to study people. The Census Bureau says that any community where 20% or more of the population has been stuck beneath the poverty level for the last 30 years is a persistent poverty community. So that's the thing I want to do. Look at, right now I call it 10, 20, 30. Targeting at least 10% of all the resources that are appropriated into those communities where 20% or more of the population's been stuck beneath the poverty level for the last 30 years. That's number two. Number three, I want to see us pass a broadband bill that will put broadband into every home. Just like we did with electricity in the 20th century, we know what electricity did for rural communities. Broadband will do the same thing today. Then number four, I want to see us pass a legislation that put a community, a federally qualified community health center within commuting distance of everybody in the country. We can do that for around $65 billion. We can do broadband for around $86 billion. I think that those four things will be priority with me. It will be life-changing. We will do broadband, will do in the 21st century what rural electricity did in the 20th century. Those would be my top four things. I like to do things in threes, but in this instance,
you're going to make an exception. Do you think D.C. statehood is something that would be will be seriously taken up anytime soon?
I think it will be seriously taken up. I don't know if you'll be able to get beyond the filibuster in the Senate.
Do you think they should do away with the filibuster?
If we do away with the filibuster?
No, I mean, yes. Do you think they should do away with the filibuster?
I'm not too sure about that. I run hot and cold on that. I do believe, though, that Mr. McConnell has taught us that maybe it's time for us to do what's necessary to get our agenda passed. And if that's what it takes, I might be inclined to be for it.
And if there were no filibuster, you think D.C. statehood is a real possibility?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, you know, it may require doing what we did with Hawaii and Alaska. You know, this whole balance, could we still hold it on to the remnants of the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Missouri Compromise, all these things that we do to maintain balance. We may have to do something like that. And, you know, some people may see Puerto Rico and the district coming along as a twofer.
Finally, the election itself. We've talked about voting and voting rights. How concerned are you about the way voting is going to come down in this election?
I'm very concerned about that. I'm extremely concerned about that. That's why I have been yelling, and I'm going to yell even louder going forward, that we need to make October election month. I think that some people will start voting around mid-September. Some states will start that. So it seems to me that we ought to have voting in person starting whenever the states say. In South Carolina, October 5th. It will be the day that absentee voting begins. And we ought to fund absentee voting in person. I have been yelling that the Colorado model ought to be followed all over the country, where they put ballot boxes in places that are convenient, all around the jurisdiction, whatever it may be, county or city, rather than having people line up with long lines in this era of social distancing, we need to stretch out voting over the whole month of October, which will culminate on November the 3rd. So that there are a lot of people who ain't going to put their votes in the mail. I always vote early, absentee, in person. I have never mailed it. I may have mailed in a ballot once, but I don't remember ever mailing in a ballot.
Kamala Harris is the vice presidential nominee now. What kind of conversations did you have with Vice President Biden leading up to that? And what does it mean to you personally? And what does it mean to the country?
It means a lot to me. I'm the father of three daughters. So you can imagine what this means to me. They were so in to having an African-American woman on this ticket. My late wife was in to having an African-American woman on this ticket. And so I'm not backing away from that. And Kamala is just a great choice. She has been tested statewide several times. She has been tested in the political arena, in the presidential stage. You know, as I was going around the state prior to the February 29th primary, one of the reasons she never got traction in South Carolina is because so many people saw her just where she is today. I had people that say to me all the time, a dream ticket would be Biden and Harris. And so this is not anything new. And so I was asked about this. You know, she's a graduate of the HBCU, mm-hmm. and she's a member of an African-American sorority. Well, I'm a graduate of HBCU too, South Carolina State. We're in the same conference for years. And I don't like them. Howard Bison.
But you were able to overcome that, huh?
I'm going to be a Howard Bison all the way through November 3rd. And I'm going to tell you something else. I'm an Omega, but I don't mind being the AKA through November 3rd as well. So I think having her on this ticket revs up so many traditions in the African-American community. Because fraternities and sororities in the African-American community are civic organizations. They're not social organizations like they are in the white community. See, when we were coming along, we could not be, we couldn't be in the Lions Club and the Rotary Club. And so fraternities and sororities were social on college campuses, but they are civic in the communities. And that's why graduate chapter of these fraternities and sororities are civic organizations. They're not social.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have a member of the what we call the Divine Nine means a lot to Black people. Mm-hmm. Having an HBCU honored this way means a lot to Black people because we couldn't go to those schools. And so they are very proud of us. So we're going to do everything we can to make Joe Biden proud of having selected her.
You are a feisty 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
How long can you keep at this? How long do you want to keep at this? Do you see transitioning out? The whole leadership of the House is in their 80s now.
Absolutely.
Kind of extraordinary for a party that has, you know, such a youthful bent to it and base to it. What are your plans?
Well, I'm not making any plans right now. I'm an avid golfer. I still golf sometimes 36 holes a day. I work as hard as I possibly can. I still have relatively good health, but I feel that it won't be long before I spend more time playing golf. And we'll see. I'm going to let the constituents and my children tell me when they think it's time for me to go. I'm not going to argue with them. If one of them ever said to me, Dad, we think it's time for you to quit, if I've not already quit, I won't argue with them at all.
Yeah, I'd put them ahead of the constituents. You don't want your constituents
absolutely.
To be the ones to ask you to go.
Yeah.
All right, Congressman, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for
good
having me.
Good to see you again.
Okay, buddy.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Jeff Fox, Hannah McDonald, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.